Welcome to the NHL Wraparound Podcast, featuring Neil Smith, President, General Manager of the 1994 Stanley Cup champion New York Rangers, and longtime ESPN NHL veteran Vic Morin. Together, they share no-nonsense opinions on news and issues around the National Hockey League. Whether you're a casual or diehard fan, each episode of NHL Wraparound will leave you more informed. Now, here's your hosts, Neil and Vic.
Welcome to NHL Wraparound, Vic Morin and Neil Smith. And boy, Vic, the trade deadline's coming up real soon. My favorite time of year, the trade deadline. It's when Brian Burke said that general managers lose their minds. And I think they do get impulsive near the trade deadline.
They certainly do. And Friday at 3 p.m., all the work will be done. And what teams have, that's what they're going to war with the rest of the way.
I wonder if anybody will pull off four trades that day.
They might pull off four, but I don't quite think they're going to have the effect that you did 30 years ago in New York.
Well, that was a lot of fun. But anyway, let's hear from our sponsor.
From Howard Hughes, from Bellavota Bedard, we're your source for game-worn jerseys. Go to mygray.com, M-E-I-G-R-A-Y.com, to start your collection today. Get real. Get it from iGray.
Vic, I see your stick. I'm giving you the puck. What's the one-timer?
Firing it towards the net here with the Nashville Predators. They came out of the All-Star break 1-2, including a 9-2 loss against Dallas in mid-February. And at that point, head coach Andrew Brunette and GM Barry Trotz decided to cancel a team event to see you two at the Sphere in Las Vegas. So they did wind up winning their very next game in St. Louis, but instead of going to Vegas, they went back to Nashville. And oh, long and behold, seven more wins later, including a really impressive game against Colorado Saturday, the team is running an eight-game winning streak. So the ultimate example, short-term pain, long-term gain.
And what a gain it's been. Well, my one-timer, Vic, is sort of a breaking news thing that's happened over the last 24 to 48 hours. I'll start off with, we'll go bad news, good news, bad news. And for the Detroit Red Wings that have had an incredible year this year, they've lost their captain again, Dylan Larkin, for 2 weeks through a lower body injury, which is a huge blow, as we all know how good Dylan Larkin is and what he means to the Detroit Red Wings. And Detroit, right there in that second last wild card spot in the East, we'll see if they can keep their stuff going while their captain sits on the side. Good news, Ilya Lyubushkin, out on the ice skating with the Toronto Maple Leafs after taking that bad hit from Remke of the Rangers when he went headfirst into the boards. He left that game. He did not return, but he is skating, and they say that he's okay, which is fantastic news for the young player himself and for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Other bad news, and boy, oh boy, these guys just can't keep getting bad news. That's the Columbus Blue Jackets. They've had so many bad things happen this season. Now they've lost young Kent Johnson to shoulder surgery, which will completely finish his season. And there goes one more player. I don't know how many pieces of bad luck one organization can have more than the Blue Jackets have had this season.
It's just amazing how many things you need to go right during the course of an NHL season between injuries, playing well, and whatnot. And the one thing about the NHL, breaking news always prevalent. This one-timer segment has been brought to you by the Ninsel Wealth Partners. Our goal is to be your primary source of financial advice. Our mission is to provide quality strategies customized to your needs. We recognize that you place your trust in our ability to help you achieve your goals. To us, there's no greater honor, and without question, there's no greater responsibility. Neil, the trade deadline coming up, as we have said, Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern time. And I think something that would be interesting for our viewers is to hear about kind of the different styles that general managers have when they approach the deadline.
Yeah, and of course, the trading deadline today, you know, in 2024 isn't the same trading deadline of yesteryear when it was a lot later in the season. And also, people waited till the last minute. Teams with a 32-team league now, that's 11 more than when I was in the driver's seat. They seem to make trades coming up to the deadline, but not all on the deadline. But the, some GMs will call and ask you about a certain player. Some GMs will just call and say, are you going to do anything? Do you need anything? Those kind of leading questions to get you to talk about perhaps there's a match there. And there's some GMs that will focus solely on what they need and forget about everything else. And then there are other GMs that will do fishing expeditions, basically going around to everybody, finding out what they've got and dipping their toe in the water everywhere they can. Personally, I felt that was a waste of time. I just wanted to go and try to deal with the people that I knew had something that I could use. And I had to find out if I had something they could use.
When a trade gets done, how difficult is it to tell a player that he's been moved? You know, what, take us inside that process. You know, does it come from you? Does it come from the agent? Take us through that.
Well, no, it doesn't come from the agent. It comes from the general manager, or it should. Sometimes it would come from the coach, depending on the circumstances. I mean, if the player's at practice and the general manager's not there and the coach is right there, maybe he'll have the coach say, you know, you got to go call Neil or something like that, or tell him and then say, call Neil for the final details or whatever. The thing that's really hard about trading hockey players is that although it's part of the business and although it's something they signed up for, you got to treat them as you would want to be treated. They've got usually got certainly a girlfriend, a wife, children, mother, father, people all over the place, a house, cars. And for you to all of a sudden say, okay, it's over here. You got to go to a different state or even a different country, or you've got to, you know, get your kids out of school or leave your wife behind for the rest of the school year while you go someplace else. You got to be caring about all those things, and you've got to be understanding when it's upsetting to the player. You can't just turn around and say, well, tough luck, you signed up for this. You don't do that. Or I don't think you'll have the job very long if you do it that way. So you just got to be sensitive to the sensitivities of what the players are going through.
It's a business, but there's also an enormous human side to this. And I think that a lot of fans don't really appreciate how taxing that could even be for you as a GM.
Well, it's very taxing. And again, you know, my own personality is that I like being liked. I admit it. I like being liked. And before I made my first trade ever of somebody from our team, I was up all night. I couldn't sleep. Like, what was it going to be like when I told this guy he's traded? And I remember doing it. And it was Michel Petit. I traded him from the Rangers to Quebec Nordiques for Randy Moeller. Randy Moeller, who's now the color commentator for the Florida Panthers. And I admit it, I was up all night. And then I went to the airport and picked Randy Moeller up when he landed. There were charter flights then. There were not charter flights then. They were all commercial flights. And Randy still talks about that to this day, that I went to the airport to pick him up on that trade. But again, you know, it can be a business where, you know, you're not going to be liked all the time. You're not, because no matter what, how hard you try, you've got to do your job and you've got to look after your organization. And there's going to be decisions that you're going to make that people won't like, especially fans. I mean, when I traded Mike Gartner, I still to this day hear about that, oh, that was my favorite player. I hated when you traded Mike Gartner. And I said, well, I hated it too. But, you know, I had to do what I had to do. So I think just as long as you're a caring person and you really sincerely care about your players and your coaches, then you get through it okay.
The Gartner trade notwithstanding, I think you were pretty well liked after 1994. But put you on the spot here for a second, that aside from any of the deals that were connected to that championship team, what is the one deal that you're most proud of that is apart from 94?
I'd say that the deal that really worked out for us and propelled us into the Final Four in 97 was the trade for Russ Courtnell and Esa Tiikanen coming back from Vancouver for his second stint. We went on to beat Florida, who had gone to the final the year before. We went on to then beat the Devils, who had beaten us quite a few times during the regular season. And we just got beat up badly and had a lot of injuries and played a really hard, big, strong Philadelphia team. And they came out on top in that series. And then, of course, they went and played Detroit and got swept by the Red Wings in 1997. That was the first Red Wings Cup since 1955. So, but I am looking back, very proud about the coming out on top with Russ Courtnell and Esa Tiikanen back in 97.
The legacy continues. You've already heard us talking about our Doer jeans. We have ours in blue, and we have to say that those jeans are good for almost any type of event that you go to. Doer makes stretch performance denim and lifestyle apparel for men and women. Doer has five times the stretch of traditional denim, is antibacterial, and that means less washing, and they're designed to last for years. It's time to level up your wardrobe with Doer. Order your pair today. Check out Doer's flagship stores in LA and Denver or shop online at shopdoer.com/NHLfan. Right now, our listeners can get 20% off site-wide when you use our special URL. Don't wait to get 20% off. Go to shopdoer.com/NHLfan. That's shopdoer.com/NHLfan. And welcome back to NHL Wraparound. It is now my pleasure to bring in three-time Stanley Cup winner with the Montreal Canadiens and the current TV analyst for the Tampa Bay Lightning, Brian Engblom. Brian, thanks so much for joining us. Been a long time since our days back at ESPN in the early 90s through 2004. And now that you're with Tampa, you're doing the single team, much easier to prepare just for doing one club as opposed to the many teams that you had to cover while working with ESPN?
Yeah, it's great to see you, Vic and Neil. Always good to see you guys. Yeah, it's very different. You know, Neil knows this too, that when you're doing national stuff, you have to take both sides of the story and make sure you try to balance everything out as best as possible. When you work for a team, it's different. I mean, you're dealing with your fans first. So virtually everything, unless the team's getting slaughtered, you know, then you take the opposing team's viewpoint just to sort of let off the gas pedal, you know, on your own team. But otherwise, you sort of look at everything from your team's standpoint. That's the way I've always approached it. I mean, that's the feedback that you get from fans, and that's, you know, the logical way to do it. Your fans want to know about your team, your guys, what happened to my guy in that situation. But at the same time, you still want to give, you know, fair balance stuff. I mean, when you're talking about Connor McDavid and McKinnon and, you know, you name it, on and on and on, you got to give them fair value. There's no doubt. But I'm talking about, you know, plays and battles and things like that. You kind of do look at it from a different aspect than when you're doing national games.
Brian, talking about your own team and Tampa, and I, you know, I've said to people in the last few days, in regards to having you on the show, I said, you know, Tampa, everybody thinks when they hear the name Tampa Bay Lightning, well, you're talking about a powerhouse. They're up there with the Leafs and the Bruins and the Rangers, and they're going to be, and it's not that way in the standings. They still have the, you know, some amazing hockey players on the team, but to me, they got a little bit of the Chicago syndrome, meaning that, you know, they won a couple of cups, and this is what happens to cup winners. You start to get less depth than you had. It seems like right now the games played column is an enemy because you played so many games and they've had difficulty on the road. And it's a battle for a team that has the prospect of having the MVP of the league, has a Norris Trophy candidate, and Vasilevsky and net, and I can go on and on, Braden Point and on and on. But Give us some perspective on the Tampa team right now.
Yeah, it's been interesting because virtually all year, Neil, the Lightning have played more games than everybody else. I think they still have five games on one or two teams. At one point, Ottawa, in their own division, was seven games behind. Like, I don't remember big gaps like that. But for whatever reason, that's what's happened. So right now, we're in the midst this week of 4 days in between games. The Lightning only play Thursday and Saturday this week. Next week is exactly the same. They only play Thursday and Saturday. So they'll have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday off this week and next week, which, as you guys know, is very unusual for any team. You're playing at least three games a week. So by the end of next week, we should have a better idea, I think, because these other teams are obviously playing. They have to, especially the ones that are three and four games behind. So I think we'll have a lot better idea of where the Lightning actually are in the standings because, yeah, everybody has at least one game on them. And are they going to win those games or are they not? Now, the games are a lot harder to win this time of year, as we all know, compared to maybe October and November. Maybe that'll be an advantage for the Lightning. But the problem is that you're looking at probably, including the Lightning, maybe six teams for the two wildcard spots. That's a lot. So if you beat two or three, that may not be enough, right? And you still may be out. So they are well aware of that, and they know they have to pile up the points consistently. And Coops talked like that for the last several years. Just get in. Just get in. I mean, they were first overall a couple of years ago, whatever year that was. And even then he said, yeah, it's great, but it doesn't matter. And then they had that year where they lose to Columbus in the first round. And everything is for naught, you know, like nobody cares in the end. And the team doesn't care about being first overall. So trying to knock yourself out to do that, that's one thing. If it happens, hey, great. But it really, what it does is it adds to the pressure, right? Because we all know that, and I've been saying this ever since I've been around the league, is because I experienced it in Montreal. The pressure for the good teams is in the first two rounds, not the last two rounds. By the time you get to the conference finals, the engine's starting to smooth out. And if you're healthy enough, you've got a really good chance to get back where you're familiar with. That means the Stanley Cup finals. And then, you know, whatever happens, happens. They've got the core players who've already been through that. They've won twice. They've also lost. And so they know the feeling. They know what it takes. So if you get through those first two rounds, that's what it's about. So setting the table that way, the team has got a lot of miles on it, for sure. I don't know that there's anybody around over the last 4 years who's got more miles on him than Victor Hedman, right? That he'd be the first one I would think about because he's a defenseman. He plays all those minutes, plays in every situation, on and on and on and on. So you can tell that, you know, it's affected the last year or so. So he's a great pro and a great talent. So he's learned to adapt to that. And how does he handle it? You can go back over the generations, the teams that won multiple cups, and look at their defensemen and go, yeah, these guys are smart enough. That's why they are who they are. Now, the third and fourth lines have not been as good as they had hoped. They haven't had as much scoring depth as they need. The top two lines drive the ship. And that's true on every team. I know that. But this team, it's this year, it's very noticeable that it's much more so that way than it was, especially in the cup years. And production from the defense has been not as high. It's been better the last month. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I can feel it and I can see the way they're playing. So is it a different team than the cup years? Absolutely. There's no doubt. And the wear and tear, no doubt on everybody, including Vasilevsky. But even though the fact he missed the first 20 games of the year because of the back surgery that he had to have in training camp. So it is a very different feel this year. And I'm not sure, as we know, the trade deadline is coming up in a few days. And I'm as interested as anybody to see what Julien Brisebois does.
We're going to circle back to that in a little bit, but one thing that has been very consistent is the brilliance of Nikita Kucherov, who, Brian, he's got to be the best bargain in the NHL at $9.5 million when you've got Matthews, MacKinnon, and McDavid all making between $3 and $4 million more per season. What have you seen different from him that an already great player has raised his level even further this season?
Cooch is as driven a player, driven for excellence as anybody I have ever seen. Like, talk dedication even doesn't quite cut it. He's got an NHL net in his garage. He's got the fake ice. I think on a bad night, he goes home at 2 a.m. and stick handles and shoots pucks in the net. I know for a fact he was doing that. I hope he takes a day off every once in a while now because he's been doing it for a long time. But he is maniacal. I'd even go that far. Maniacal about details. When we show shots of him on the bench after every shift, they automatically hand him the tablet on the bench. Every shift he comes off, he and Braden Point talk a lot. And Braden has told me he's learned so much from him. He has a mind like very, very few players ever in the game. I mean, ever. Go back to whatever, the great name, you pick it from any generation. And Cooch's mind is right there. I've been around him enough, seen enough, talked to the other players. He doesn't say anything. Like, I go to him and I'll ask him a question. For him, it's tradecraft. He won't speak about it. He just say, I saw the guy. I give it to him. That's it. That's all he's going to say. He's not going to say what went on in his head. What did he read? What did he do? Every once in a while, I'll get a glimpse from Braden Point or somebody else who's had a conversation with Cooch. And, you know, you kind of get glimpses here and there and you put the pieces together. And that's how you get a read on Nikita Kucherov. He is way ahead in the shots department. I mean, 4 years ago, they were saying, Cooch, shoot the puck, please. Please shoot the puck more. He's got a brilliant shot, both one timer, wrist shot is as good as I've seen in a really long time. He brings it back behind his left foot, all the way behind the foot and disguises it. He's got that big, you know, the toe curve like this. And he knows that weapon, man, so well. It is unreal. He'll get that puck and just sling it from his back foot. It's almost like highlight. And he just, it's silent. You know, there's guys who take the shots. They take big ice. They pound the puck. Ovechkin's, totally the opposite, right? He's pounding the puck. Kucherov is stealth bomber. You don't see it. You don't feel it. It's laser surgery and boom, he's already done it to you. And his brain works the same way. He orchestrates what he sees in front of him based on what the D-men are doing. He brings people to him. He is so different than MacKinnon and McDavid. And let's go to the All-Star game. And people really got on him, especially because it was in Toronto. You know, that stick handling thing, and he lost the puck and whatever. And then he just kind of walked through it. First of all, he doesn't really want to be there. He doesn't like that stuff. He doesn't want, you know, the attention. But those drills are made for the McDavids and the MacKinnons and the Barzells. You watch Nikita Kucherov play. When he gets the puck, he slows down. He doesn't speed up like those guys. He doesn't dominate the play once he has the puck on his stick with speed. He's already moved to the open, give it to me now, and then he slows down. And he brings one guy, he brings two guys, and makes a few moves, makes a few shifts, sees what he sees. He takes more shots now. I don't know the exact total, but I know it's in the neighborhood of 200 attempted shots more this year than he had at this time last year. So that's a guy who is definitely shooting more.
You talk about a shooter, too, on that team, and he's been there for 16 years now, as Steven Stamkos. And the fact that he's not signed is surprising. I mean, obviously, to a lot of people, including me, you know, that I know there's obviously a method to the madness with the general manager. But what's your thoughts on that? And no inside information, but I mean, where is that going?
Well, I don't have any inside information, so I don't have to cover anything up. This is all my opinion. And Neil, you've been through this. You know what it's like to have guys like that near the end of their careers, and they're a huge name. Julian Brie and Stammer started it at the beginning of the year when he said openly words to the effect of, we didn't have any conversations this summer, and I was a little surprised at that. Now, I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically the message he sent out. And everybody kind of went, okay, he's not real happy about that. That was pretty obvious. He didn't belabor it. He didn't say it with anger. He said it. Smart. And, you know, he has deserved it, right? His career and who he is in this city and in the league, he's deserved the right to say whatever he wants. So then Julian came right back, I think the same day or the next day, because everybody went right to him. And he was very practical about it. But he had started off, as you might imagine, saying, we know who Stephen Stamkos is to us. Believe me, we know what he's like in the community. We know what he's like on the ice. We have the utmost respect for him. We are doing the best for the organization that we can. And he basically left it at that. So there you have the two sides. And whatever is after that fact or has happened since, this goes back to training camp, beginning of the year. Whatever has happened since then, I don't know how many conversations they've had, but it's an interesting conversation for sure. I would love to be a fly on the wall for that one. I don't know what they're going to do. Like what's in Stammer's mind? Is his ego going to be such that I want to be up there with the top paid guys in the league because of who I am? I don't know if he's going to do that. He's what, 16 years into the league. Is he going to say to himself, I want to play 20? You know, that's another 4-year deal. So if you're Julian, how much is too much and how much is too many? That's a really difficult question to answer on both sides. And yeah, I can't wait to find out the answer.
Brian, I want to go back now to the trade deadline. And Tampa Bay's kind of got a very interesting dynamic that they've been able to keep the cap down. Julian Brisbois has done a great job with that. Leading up to the deadline, they've got almost $7.4 million of cap space. What's unusual about this also is that while they've been able to save money, they've got a lot of players tied up long term. Kucherov has 3 more years after this year. Point, Cirelli, Paul, Hagel, Cernak have 5 years, and Vasilevsky has 4 years. So as the deadline approaches, knowing that Sergachev is going to be out for at least the rest of the regular season, what is the first major piece that's going to fall for Julian Brisbois when he makes the deals at the trade deadline? Or will he?
Yeah, that's the only reason they have so much cap space is because Sergachev is out for the rest of the season. He's had a really, really tough year, and it's been tough for the team because of it. He's a top level defenseman who makes a lot of bucks. So that has opened it up. So the obvious thing would they need another left side D? The Lightning have used, I think they've had 8 guys call up and down this year from their American League team. Very unusual. I think 7 guys have played their first ever National Hockey League game. So they have really gone through the organization and go, what do we have? Right. But Neil, also you would know this. And I keep just from being around so long, I keep thinking, who else is watching? Who else is watching? Who else has had conversations maybe and said to Julian, okay, well, you're talking about this guy. Yeah, we know about him in your American League team. You play him in the NHL, right? You guys get those kind of calls, Neil, right? You did. And so I know it happened. So this is just me speaking. And as I said, I have zero inside information. I have not talked to Julian about it. And he is a very closed, withdrawn, smart guy. He doesn't let anything out about what he's thinking except to the people that work with him. So this is just me thinking and my observations based on my experiences. So they have a pretty good understanding of, yeah, this guy can play. This guy needs some more time. That's what it's all about. You have to do that more so than we've seen in the last 4 years, I would say. Their deadline deals were extraordinarily good, you know, leading into the cup years and, of course, the cup years. And now, if not all of them, most of them, a lot of them are gone because they made, you know, they made so much money and did so well. Yanni Gourde, those guys going back several years, they're all gone, right? Blake Coleman, Goodrow, gone. And they were instrumental. They were two great deals, two of the best examples. Brandon Hagel's still here. And for me, he's one of the best players. He might be second on the team or slash 2-3 on the team after Kucherov as far as value to the team this year. And they got him near the deadline too, if I remember right. So this year, going back to last year's deadline and the signings that they've had this year, guys have been hurt and it hasn't worked out as well as they had hoped. And I'm sure as well as the players had hoped. Connor Sherry is a good example. Sherry's a really good experienced player. It's played with top level players, played with Crosby a lot in Pittsburgh, played with Malkin a lot in Washington. So, I mean, I envisioned, I'm sure they did, of, you know, he's going to play anywhere from maybe a little bit of first line all the way to the third line, up and down. It hasn't happened that way. Starting to come around a little bit now. He got hurt early. I'm not sure exactly what all it is. I'm not laying it all on him. I'm just using him as the first example that I could think of. So things haven't gone as smoothly with the guys that they brought in for those third and fourth line roles. And that has been, you know, an issue. Same thing on defense. You have that turnover. That goes back to losing Ryan McDonagh a couple of years ago now. And what a loss that was, you know, just extraordinarily big, because he was that guy that could, when the game was going sideways, he could just grab it, you know, grab the game. And I've always compared him to Serge Savard. He was like Serge for me. He just grabbed the game back and go, whoa, okay, turn the ship around, and seemed to single-handedly help smooth things out. And just the way he played that classic style, and always this huge presence on the ice and in the locker room. So that was a big loss. So ever since then, you're trying to find ways to make up for it. And yeah, as you mentioned, I mean, just like Chicago, LA, you know, after a cup wins, a few cup wins, it gets more difficult, and the Lightning are in a similar position now.
Brian, quickly before we take a break, the name that is linked closest to Tampa right now is Noah Hanifin with Calgary, and he would certainly fill a huge void on defense. If that were to come to pass, what would that cost the Lightning?
That's a question probably more for Neil than me. That's one thing I'm not very good at. I don't know what the market is and how those deals work. I could say something off the top of my head and be so far off base, it's crazy. As you go, when Neil was with the Ranger and everything, you hear those stories. I know, look at him smiling already, like people saying stuff and going, are you kidding? That's ridiculous. No way that, you know, play Team X is going to get that guy for, you know, for X amount. It's crazy. Yeah, he's a left side defenseman to replace Sergachev. So that's the logical part of it. But what's the cost? And yes, I'm aware, like everybody is, I don't know all the numbers off the top of my head, but the Lightning have traded away a lot of first and second round picks and third round picks over the last 4 years. To get the cup teams that they had. And you know what? I have no problem with that, because they won. There are tons of teams that over the years have stockpiled draft picks and then booted the draft picks all over the park and have not even come close to getting to the Stanley Cup finals. So if you look back and you tell me that the Tampa Bay, like, well, they traded away all their draft picks, I go, yeah, absolutely they did. And they won twice, right? You know, so stop wherever you're going to go negatively after that. So what do they have for Hanifin? They have players in the American League, if you could put a package together. And who says it doesn't mean that somebody off the team comes? You know, Julian Brisebois is a very bright guy, and he's been around the block for a few years now, not just as GM, but as assistant GM too. And organizationally with Montreal, doing the arbitration cases and everything. He's a well-rounded guy who knows the business every which way, upside down. So if you see that you're a team that is not what it used to be, who says, and I wouldn't put it past Julian, that not just a little player here or a little player there to make a difference, then maybe he goes, now is the time. GMs are hungry this time of year, right? Maybe it's easier to make a bigger deal now at the deadline when there's all these balls in the air than it is maybe in the summer. In summer, you have more time to deal with it, but I wouldn't put it past them either. that somebody off the roster comes in and you get maybe two or three guys going out. There, the guy right here on the screen with us did that once. I kind of famously remember a few years back. Huh, Neil?
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah. And it worked.
Yeah, well, yeah, thankfully, that's why I'm here now. If it hadn't, I probably wouldn't have a podcast.
Trade deadline coming up Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, the new enforcer in New York. First, a word from Migraine.
Time now for a quick shout out to our sponsor. NHL Wraparound is brought to you by Migray, your source for game worn jerseys. Head to migray.com to get your collection started today. Get real, get it from Migray. NHL Wraparound subscribers can take 10% off any hockey jersey when they order at migray.com and use the coupon code WRAP10. Don't forget that coupon code, WRAP10.
Welcome back to NHL Wraparound. So we're going to have a little discussion here about Matt Remke, the rookie of the New York Rangers, the new enforcer in town. But before I do it, Brian, how many fights did you have in your NHL career according to HockeyFights.com?
I have no idea. I've never looked it up. Maybe two or three a year, you know, but everybody had to fight a little bit back then. I honestly have no idea.
According to that website, you had 13 in your career, and the most you had was four in the 1978-79 season. So a little bit of info there. So wanted to ask you now about Remke. He has had four fights coming into this week with Matt Martin, Nick Delorier, Matthew Olivier of Columbus, and Ryan Reeves of Toronto. And for all of the headlines, for all of the spotlight, for all of the good feeling in New York that they've got an enforcer, this guy has really received some big blows so far. And when does this get to the point that this is potentially a tragedy in the making?
Well, that's something we've been dealing with for the last 25 years or so, right? You can go back to guys like Chris Nyland and guys from that generation, and there were lots of them, and WHA guys and the heavyweights, because there was so much more fighting back then. And we know the stories and the head injuries and the concussions and multiple concussions and what it can do. I don't know all the information. Sure, I've read the articles and, you know, I've talked to some of the guys for sure. The game was what it was back then, and it's nothing like that. And you look, that's good. We used to have bench clearing brawls all the time, and it was stupid. It was. And I'm glad all that's gone. Am I still a proponent of fighting? Yes, I am, to a point. I am. That makes me old school, whatever. Call me whatever. But I don't think you can depend on the referees and the league to tame players' minds, motivations, and emotions. Fear does. Absolutely. Fear does. And so if you are going to take a run at one of the top players on my team, my guy, you know, whoever that is, and for the Rangers, it's Remke now. And I think they needed that because they've got a skilled team. They've got a very good team, and intimidation is still a big factor. People, I think, don't appreciate that. You get in the playoffs, the stuff that's said, Not just the hits, you know, it's the psychological warfare. It's the threats. And some of those threats come through. And if you don't have somebody who stands up and goes, not that guy. Nope. Me. Come to me. That's why do you think Toronto got Ryan Reeves? Because they had been up against the Tampa Bay Lightning and they lost and then they beat them. I realized that. And it didn't always get to the point of everybody running at everybody and getting stupid. Two really good hockey teams that played hockey. But the Lightning had Pat Maroon, and Pat Maroon did a hell of a job the entire time he was here. But he wasn't the only one. One of the cup years, I think it was the first one, they played against the Islanders. And there was an old-fashioned standoff at center ice, I want to say in game two or game three, from two or three guys from the Islanders and two or three guys from the Lightning in the warm-up. That was 1978 hockey. right? And you had to be there. And if there was nobody there to talk or say, nobody threw a punch, no, whatever, just a lot of eyeballing and jawing going on while everybody else is skating around. Did that set the tone? That's the kind of intimidation I'm talking about. And the Lightning had no problem handling that. And Pat was in the middle of it, but he wasn't alone. You have to have it. I'm convinced when I saw Toronto sign Ryan Reeves, I went, you guys are pretty smart. You were lacking that before. You needed somebody like that. And I think the Rangers needed somebody like Remke. And really interesting what those two did to each other just the other night in Toronto.
I come from the same generation as you, Brian. We're very close in age. In fact, I'm going to tell the audience how close we are in age. In 1975, you were a Division I All-American for Wisconsin. And in 1975, I was a Division II All-American for Western Michigan University. How about that one? So we're very close. I wanted to skip to something else that I find really peculiar. And I'm one of these people, as you may know, that always sort of sees things in a different light and tries to take a different look at things. And I know you wore a Jofa helmet in your day, which is basically a broomball helmet put on a hockey player, correct? Here's two things I want to ask you about, just for interest's sake. If you punch somebody in the face in hockey, and you can punch him three or four times in the face, you get a 5-minute penalty. Okay. If you accidentally tap somebody on their helmet with your stick, you get a 2-minute penalty. Now, why has he got a helmet on? If whenever anybody touches him on the helmet, they get a penalty. I mean, you might as well have no helmet on. My point is our game is so peculiar in so many ways that, you know, this high sticking penalty that you get now for just accidentally, like you just, you got thrown off balance and my stick hit you in the helmet. I get a penalty, you know, but you and I drop the gloves and I'll punch you three or four times in the face. I get 3 more minutes than I did for just accidentally tapping you on the head. We come from the same era. I believe that there's got to be an enforcer in the game. I believe that you've got to have a threat, or else there is going to be a lot of stick work and there is going to be little guys going around doing things to the guys, as well as, you know, you're going to have some tough guys try to do bad things to our best players. And we got no threat to go back at them with. But coming from the same era, again, I come back to that. Isn't it peculiar where the game sits today in that realm?
Yeah. I mean, look, if you look at the history, you know, nobody wore helmets back in the day. Then there were 2-3 guys in the entire league. And then now, you know, a long time ago, they made everybody put helmets on. So the thing that when you talk to the guy, and I did when I was playing, talk to the guys from the Gordie Howe era, they'd say, yeah, it's all well and good. You guys wear helmets and mandatory. And now you have, of course, the face shields. What you do is the feeling of invincibility goes way up. Like, I've got a helmet on and a visor, and it's a really good helmet. Now guys don't slow down, and they don't have that automatic fear of a stick or hands coming up in the face. Everybody has a natural aversion to getting hit in the head. Like, you go like this right away, right? In everyday life, something happens around your head, the first thing you do is get out of the way, right? It's human instinct. Well, you start getting more covered up. The NFL was the same way. Way, way back in the NFL, the helmets were awful and they didn't wear face guards. Well, you know, and look where they are now. So that just sort of emphasizes my point. The feeling for an athlete, especially in a contact sport, those two contact sports, you take away, you increase the feeling of invincibility. Like, nothing is going to hurt me. So the velocity of everything has gone up. The velocity of the game and the velocity of the hits are incredible. For me, one of the biggest oversights that I've seen over the years is I did not like it when the NHL clamped down on when you take a guy into the board, you kind of wrap him up and take him into the wall, you know, because, it was holding, right? They really clamped down on the holding. And I remember Brian Burke came out against that and said, you know, this is going to be trouble. I agreed with them at the time, and I have ever since. To me, that was a mistake, because now you have an entire generation that we're playing in the league where players don't recognize how many hits do we see from behind because the game is so fast. Some players invite it, which I can't even. I saw Mark Messier went off on that a couple of weeks ago. I went, attaboy, mess. He said something to the effect of, I played 25 years. I would have played 5 years if I'd have played like some of these guys, the way they get hit on the wall, turn their back to a player and get hit face first into the glass. I was glad that Mark said that coming from him. It's true. Some guys do it on purpose to draw a penalty. You got to be nuts to do that. You got to be crazy because you don't know until after the fact how much it hurt you. But my point is when I hit, I knew, and I knew a guy might be turned. You came in and you had like the stick around one side and you kind of used your other hand and you kind of lifted him up and you hit him into the glass like that. So you controlled him. You didn't take a run at him. So if he made a move and you know the game is so fast and there's a last minute move and these guys are not trained very well. They don't work on this. And so you get a partial hit. You get a guy who's turning back this way and he's face onto the glass. And the defensive guy has come in with so much speed. Sorry, guys. Cold and flu season. And they don't slow down. They don't recognize the danger, how vulnerable that guy is. They're taught by their coach, hit that guy, eliminate him. You let him get by, we're in trouble. He's going to the front of the net. He's going to score. That's what the player's thinking. He's not trying to hurt somebody. Which once in a while, maybe guys, the wing nuts are, but that's by far few and far between. It's the thought is, I have to stop him. I have to stop him. And this is the way I have to do it. I've got to hit him. Whereas before, you could wrap him up a little bit. And it was holding back then, too. If you held on too long, it was holding. You do it, you wrap him up, you let him go. It's not holding. So anyway, that's my 2 cents worth there. And so the hits to the head, the bad hits to me still have a lot to do with that because you are taught to make an impact, to eliminate your player. And to me, it leads to a lot of bad stuff and a lot of injuries we've had in the last 15, 20 years almost.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us today, not only to talk about the Tampa Bay Lightning and their chase for the playoffs, but also some great historical perspective on the physical play of the NHL then and now.
Well, thanks very much, guys. I'm glad you guys have this podcast. It's terrific. You've both been around a long time, seen it from different angles, and we've known each other for a long time here. It's all good stuff, and I'll be watching your shows. Thanks for having me.
Look forward to seeing you again. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
This is The Human Side of the Story, being brought to you by UBS Financial Services. And we had a real special guest on earlier in the show, and you have more background and info on Brian Engblom.
And that's my human side of the story today is about a wonderful guy that we just had on the show that I've known for many years and is a contemporary of mine, and that is Brian Engblom. I want to give you some background on Brian. He was born in Winnipeg, Manitoba, and went from there to the University of Wisconsin, played 2 years there, was drafted by the Montreal Canadiens 22nd overall, joined the Canadiens after his season at Wisconsin, and actually played in the playoffs, but his name didn't go on the cup in 1977 because he hadn't played in any regular season games. He did, however, go on to win two more Stanley Cups with the Montreal Canadiens in 78 and 79, completing Montreal's four in a row. And from there, he lists a couple of highlights of his career. He says he's most proud of making Team Canada in 1981. He said that his most painful moment that he ever had in hockey was when the doctor actually told him that because of bone spurs in his spine, he could no longer play hockey, wasn't allowed to play. And he said, that's a really tough thing to get over. And I know it is too, even with my career. Once you find that you can't play hockey anymore, it's a tough thing to live with. He said one of his most embarrassing moments was playing for the LA Kings. And they were in Edmonton during Edmonton's huge days of having the dream team. LA got ahead 7-2 by the end of the second period. And they're all in the dressing room in Edmonton saying, wow, this is great. We got this one in the bag. They skate out for the third period. And Mark Messier's got steam coming out of his ears and lightning in his eyes. And lo and behold, Gretzky, Messier, Lowe, Fuhrer, and the bunch ends up winning 8-7. With a barrage of goals in that third period. So Brian Engblom scored his first NHL goal. Guess where? What better place to score it than on home ice at the Montreal Forum? But what better guy to have as the person who passed you the puck than Guy Lafleur and Pierre LaRouche? He's in the Manitoba Hockey Hall of Fame, and now he is the color commentator for the Tampa Bay Lightning. And I got to tell you, Vic, I love listening to Brian when he's on the broadcast. He's just so good and so smooth and so articulate and a really good human being.
He really is. He was a pleasure to work with in those years at ESPN, and to go from being an excellent defenseman, seamless transition to being an excellent broadcaster as well. And just a terrific guy, and thrilled that we were able to have him on today. My human side of the story comes off more as a public service announcement. 9 years ago, I was a little bit over 50 and had never undergone a colonoscopy. And I had gotten family pressure, but like so many men, I put it off, didn't want to do it, and didn't want to do the prep, didn't want to have an invasive procedure, and just kept putting it off. And on a Saturday afternoon, 9 years ago, a piece came on TSN on Brian Murray. And Murray had advanced cancer because he had waited until into his 60s to get his first colonoscopy. And by that time, the cancer had metastasized and spread. So that Monday, 2 days later, I booked an appointment. And the scope found 3 polyps, and one of them was a mass, which I was really scared out of my wits about. And fortunately for me, the analysis on these polyps did come up negative, but surgery was needed. And the doctors did tell me that had I waited one more year, I would have been a stage 4. And I went back and I looked at this piece again, and Flyers assistant coach Brad Shaw actually had almost the exact same story as mine. So the bottom line is, I had the surgery. I have had 3 colonoscopies since. They have all come back clean. So the message here is, if you are 45 or over, go. The prep, the invasiveness, look, we all go. So that's part of the prep. And in terms of the procedure itself, it is the best 20-minute nap you will ever have. And we all owe a debt of gratitude, me in particular, to Brian Murray for making his story so public, because it certainly helped save me.
What a compelling story. I just want to mention before we run away that we've got a great guest next week. We'll be past the trading deadline. And Mike Santos, who has a company named Team 33, which actually analyzes and has got scouts all over the league, and they analyze players, they analyze trades, they analyze free agents, and they have this information ready for whoever wants to purchase it, is going to come on and talk to us about the trading deadline and their analysis of what's gone on and their analysis of who wins, who loses in all the different trades that are done coming up to the trading deadline. So tune in next week. I think you'll really find it very interesting. We want to say thanks to MyGray, UBS, Doer, and Ninsel Financial Partners for their support. Thanks to listeners. Don't forget to subscribe. We're on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Send questions or comments to nhlwraparound@gmail.com. nhlwraparound@gmail.com. Send us anything, what you think of the show, what you'd like to hear, questions, anything, but we'd love to get your emails. Join us next Tuesday for that show that I talked to you about, which is Mike Santos and the Trading Deadline.
Thanks for joining us on the NHL Wraparound Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to stay up to date on all the NHL action.